Well, this is the box. We've borrowed so much money that we have to keep interest rates low to make that debt manageable. But by keeping interest rates extremely low, we in effect have to create a lot of new currency to make that possible. In other words, to buy the bonds that we're trying to force down in price, whose yields we're trying to force down. And that leads to inflation, which forces interest rates up because nobody wants to lend money if they're going to be paid back in a depreciating currency. So the interest rates people demand for loans go up in an inflationary environment, and that makes it impossible to manage that debt load. And that's kind of where we are right now. We have to raise interest rates because inflation is becoming problem number one. But by doing that, we're raising our debt costs to the point at which the system doesn't work anymore. You know, we'll go bankrupt trying to pay off the debts that we have at higher interest rates. And there doesn't seem to be a solution for that.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. As governments increase their debt, servicing that debt becomes a bigger and bigger problem. That's especially true if the pile of debt is growing much faster than the underlying economy, which has been the case for decades for most nations. This forces central banks to print more new currency in order to enable their governments to handle the debt service payments. But once inflation starts becoming an intractable problem and interest rates can no longer be suppressed, the system breaks. History is clear on this. So are we close to such a seminal breaking point? Dangerously close, concludes monetary historian and macro analyst John Rubino, co-author of the book The Money Bubble, along with James Turk. We're going to dig into the reasons why, as well as what steps regular investors like you can consider taking today before that breaking point is reached to protect your wealth. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, Adam. Great to be back on.
All right, John. Well, look, lots to dig into here. Real quick, before we do, let's just kick it upstairs and start with the high-level question I like to ask all the guests at the beginning of these interviews. What is your current assessment of today's global economy and financial markets?
Well, they're a huge mess, obviously. You know, we could spend the rest of the show just going through specifics, you know, which country screwed up in which way and what the consequences are. Everything is in grave danger right now, basically, out there. The problem is we don't know whether the year ahead is going to be ragingly inflationary or a tip into a almost 1930s style deflationary crash. You know, there are signs of both of those things being possible. And it's not clear which we're going to end up with, which is, that's quite a dilemma for anybody trying to manage money right now.
It is. And, you know, you could be very right where it could be a prolonged period here where there's no potentially one dominant force, right, where we're getting almost like a shearing effect, right, where we just have big disinflationary or deflationary forces, you know, applying at the same time where certain inflationary forces are still raging. You know, like, you know, you look at the cost of energy just this morning as we're talking here, Gazprom basically just told Germany, no more gas for you. Right.
We need to spend a lot of time on this whole German story because it's shockingly stupid what they did over there.
Right. All right. Well, let's do that. But the point is that, you know, energy is not going to be cheap in Germany anytime soon. Right. So, but that being said, you know, there are lots of forces, which I'm sure we'll talk about in just a couple of minutes here, that, you know, maybe showing that we're heading into recession, potentially a pretty substantial one. And so, you know, it may take a while to figure out which one of those is going to win out. But in the interim, you know, we're just getting almost like tectonic plates scraping against each other. We're just kind of getting ground between these two separate forces. Do you kind of look at that? Or am I murdering the analogy here?
No, there are two absolutely titanic forces out there. You're right. One is we borrowed an absolutely insane amount of money over the last 30 years. And excessive debt is really deflationary because when debt is excessive, by definition, that means a lot of people who borrowed money should not have borrowed money, can't make the payments. They're going to go bankrupt. They're going to stiff their creditors, et cetera, et cetera. That's really deflationary. at the same time, in order to manage all this debt, we've been creating a tidal wave of currency. What's the stat now? Is something like 60% of all the dollars that have ever been created were created in the last 2 years? So it's something like that. I don't have the numbers exactly
ridiculous.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. And that's very inflationary, obviously, because all that money has to go somewhere and it tends to chase whatever's hot. So you get these spikes in certain asset classes when you're overproducing currency. And we've still got that going too. And we've also got a lot of messed up supply chains around the world, which are leading to shortages, which is leading to higher prices, especially in food. That's the really scary thing going forward. So it's completely possible that one or the other of these forces will predominate in the year ahead. And so we'll get deflation or inflation going forward. And it's also possible that they'll keep going back and forth so that we'll never know exactly what's happening out there. And I have no idea how this is going to play out because these things are very big in isolation. You take just one or the other, the amount of money that we've created or the amount of debt we have on hand, either one of them is good for a biblical crisis. And you combine them and you get something that's kind of new in human history. We've never had this much leverage and this much potentially bad debt at the same time. So we will see.
It's interesting. You know, we all like to talk about the 800-pound gorilla in the room. It seems like we're stuck in a room with two 800-pound gorillas. You know, what's worse than being in there with an 800-pound gorilla? It's being there with two of them. All right. So, I want to dig into both, on the debt side, you are very right, which is that, excessive debt is deflationary. And, I mean, I think just the national debt alone in the country is over 30 trillion right now. But of course you add on top of that, private debt, and then you add on top of that, our entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, et cetera, all those liabilities that we have. And in some cases, you get into the hundreds of trillions in terms of total liabilities there. And that is a very, very heavy overhang. And you mentioned something really important. When you have too much debt, you get malinvestment if debt has been too plentiful and too cheap. And when malinvestment defaults, that's very deflationary. But what's also deflationary about debt is the fact that you have to service it, right? So the more debt you have, the more of your income has to go to debt service payments. So there's just less and less you have left over to run your economy with. And something that's very notable about the current era we're in right now is after a long period of record low interest rates, they're now rising. And so we have this rising cost of capital environment with debt where that interest rate payment I talked about that keeps growing as you add to your debt amount, even if you have it keeps growing even if your interest rate stays flat. But once your interest rate starts rising, well, then it's the worst of both worlds. You've got more debt and it costs you more. So there's even less left over to run your economy on. I take it this is something that you are as equally concerned as I about?
Well, yeah. We've been able to manage ever-increasing debt loads around the world by pushing interest rates down to historically low levels. You know, Japan is the perfect example of this. They basically ran up government debt that is higher on a per capita basis than in any other society in the world. And they've been able to manage it by keeping their interest rates at negative levels for a big part of the previous decade, which means the more they borrow, the lower their deficit gets because people are paying them for the privilege of buying their bonds. And that allowed them to not implode, right? But now interest rates are starting to go up. So they actually have to pay to carry the debt that they're taking on. And if this continues, you know, if Japanese average debt costs for the government go up to the place more or less where the U.S. now has to pay to borrow, that bankrupts Japan's government. They just have to pay more in interest than they are taking in from tax revenues. And they're an extreme case, but one of the reasons why the yen is plunging lately is that this dynamic has taken hold. Interest rates are going up. And if the government can't manage those interest rates, in other words, keep them from going up too much, the system blows up. And nobody really wants to hold yen in that kind of a circumstance. But you can find examples of this, this same process at work all around the world. You know, people who borrowed way too much money, expecting interest rates to stay low so that debt would be manageable. Now interest rates are going up because of the inflation from all the borrowing that they did in the past. And now they can't manage their debts anymore. So they're looking at some kind of a financial crisis out there. And mostly they haven't hit yet, you know, so we're still going to see these things play out in the coming year or two. And China is another one, but let's suffice it for now to say that borrowing too much money is inflationary, and it makes it impossible to keep interest rates low enough to cover the debt costs that you build up. And there's your dilemma. You know, your system blows up when you reach a certain point in that process.
Right. And you know this because you've written several books about monetary policy and monetary history, John. So you've noted that this, what we're seeing in Japan is not unique. It's something that's played out multiple times in history.
Yeah. If you Google list of hyperinflations, you'll get a long list of countries that in the past have borrowed too much money, created too much currency to cover their excessive debts, and then blew up their currencies in the process. This is a kind of a normal thing. You know, it's just that we haven't experienced it for a really long time, especially in the US.
Well, we being the US, yeah, I don't have the chart in front of me, but we'll pull it up and we'll if we find it, we'll put it up on the screen here when we edit this. But I remember the last time I saw it, I was struck by how many of those are in the recent past. I mean, the past recent couple of decades, right? You know, we sort of think about hyperinflation. Okay, that's Weimar Germany. That's forever ago. There's actually a number of these currencies regimes that have failed, you know, even leading up to today.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it happens over and over again. It's just that here in the U.S. especially, we've been sheltered from it by having the world's strongest economy, the reserve currency that everybody wants. And that allowed us to make a lot of financial mistakes without adding the U.S. to that list of hyperinflations. But still, there's a limit. And it does kind of feel like we're tiptoeing into that region where something like that is possible even for us. I mean, we've got double-digit inflation right now. Who would have thought 3 years ago when the Fed was talking about low inflation as being their big challenge that we would be at double-digit inflation rates? And, you know, you look at the amount of money we've created and it's kind of obvious that was going to happen. But to people with the history that the U.S. has, in other words, basically good times since 1950. In other words, the adult lifetime of virtually everybody who's alive right now, we've never had financial problems that are kind of common, as you mentioned from that list, because we've had so many advantages, but we've abused our advantages to the point where now we may just join that list at some point in the not too distant future.
Yeah, well, so a couple of things on that. One is we talk about collapse happening from the outside in, right? The weaker players fall first, right? And you see countries like Venezuela or whatever, and you can say, okay, well, that's a smaller country, you know, in the developing world. But now, to your point, we're seeing currencies begin to implode, like the Japanese yen, you know, has lost a tremendous amount of value against the US dollar since the beginning of the year. And now the euro has dropped down to parity with the US dollar. So, I mean, you're seeing the number two and number three currencies in the world, you know, begin to substantially weaken here. So it kind of just sort of shows you where we are in the story. We're far enough along here and seeing enough warning signs that we should probably take notice. And one other thing that you mentioned too about, you know, sort of us squandering our opportunity here and our advantage here in the United States, you can kind of get away with debt as long as your debt to GDP ratio is okay. In other words, if you're growing fast, then you can afford taking on that debt. But I think one of the problems that's been going on in the US for a long time, pretty much since my entire life, I'm 50, is our debts have grown much faster than our GDP has. And, you know, at some point, you know, when you're doing that, you're essentially borrowing from the future, right? And you get to a point of debt saturation, which is a term that our good friend Charles Hugh Smith has used a lot over the years, where, you know, it applies to consumers, but it also applies to countries, where you just get to a point where you've kind of taken on all the debt that the system's going to let you take on. And it just gets harder and harder to start borrowing after that. And, you know, we very well may be hitting those limits.
Yeah. Well, this is the box. We've borrowed so much money that we have to keep interest rates low to make that debt manageable. But by keeping interest rates extremely low, we, in effect, have to create a lot of new currency to make that possible. In other words, to buy the bonds that we're trying to force down in price, whose yields we're trying to force down. And that leads to inflation, which forces interest rates up because nobody wants to lend money if they're going to be paid back in a depreciating currency. So the interest rates people demand for loans go up in an inflationary environment, and that makes it impossible to manage that debt load. And that's kind of where we are right now. We have to raise interest rates because inflation is becoming problem number one. But by doing that, we're raising our debt costs to the point at which the system doesn't work anymore. You know, we'll go bankrupt trying to pay off the debts that we have at higher interest rates. And there doesn't seem to be a solution for that because, you know, as you mentioned, I've written a couple of books on this, and people in this space, in the sound money space, have been saying this was inevitable, that this was always going to happen. But we've all been saying it for such a long time that I think a lot of people kind of concluded that it would never happen because it hadn't happened yet. Well, you know, it looks like it kind of is happening now. And that's why next year is such a fascinating year, because we have to resolve it in some way. We can't keep going the way we are. We can't have 10% inflation going forward, because that'll cause everybody to front run the inflation once they conclude it's permanent, and panic buy everything in sight, which will spike inflation, which will, you know, spike.
And that's true hyperinflation, yeah. Right? Yeah. That's when people basically lose faith in the future buying power of the currency.
Yeah, there's a term for that called the crack up boom in the Austrian School of Economics, which is basically, yeah, when everybody decides they're going to take their currency, as soon as they get it, as soon as they get paid, they're going to turn it into real stuff because they don't believe the price of real stuff will ever stop going up. And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the reason that the Fed is acting with such dispatch now, you know, they're going to raise interest rates another 75 basis points, it looks like, at the next meeting, is because they see that possibility that the system just spins out of control when people give up on the currency. And they want to try to head it off. But as I said, if they head it off with higher interest rates, that blows us up from a different direction. So it's not clear that there's any kind of a fix out there short of a massive currency devaluation and a monetary reset to some kind of a system that doesn't allow the government just to inflate the currency away again. And that's going to be really painful if it's imposed on us by the market. It'll be chaos. And if it's imposed on us by the government making the decision to do it, so, say some Sunday night, they just announced that we're back on the gold standard Monday morning at much higher prices, then that that hurts all the people who trusted the government and are on fixed incomes or have lots of big bank accounts denominated in dollars. You know, so the people that trusted the government are the ones who get hurt most. And then you get civil unrest. Which we're already kind of seeing all around the world.
But you kind of get that the other way too, right? If you just let the market clear it too.
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's any way to avoid political chaos after we build up these kinds of debts. And you know, the U.S., see, once again, we're kind of insulated from so much of this stuff. But if you look around the world, there is civil unrest everywhere. There's somebody posted a list of countries that are now seeing riots and other kinds of demonstrations. And the list was like 24 countries long or something like that. There's a lot of stuff going on out there.
And right. They're not all tiny countries anymore either. Right. No, and you and I mean, John, we talk a lot, you know, we're friends. We talk a lot outside of the camera here. And we've been pretty worried for the past year or so as we've been seeing this rising inflation of, you know, a repeat of the Arab Spring, except this is sort of a global version of it, right? Because, you know, what was sort of a driving factor of the Arab Spring a decade ago was you had these countries where all of a sudden food and fuel prices jumped so far so quickly just kind of overnight, people couldn't feed their families. They couldn't, you know, keep them warm or anything. And they had no other option but to rise up against the government. And, you know, that seems like we're seeing that play out in a lot of different places, Sri Lanka just being the latest example, you know, of the past week.
Yeah. When a family is just being able, just barely able to manage gas in the car, food on the table, and rent each month, and you raise the price of all those things, you force them to not pay one of those bills. And then that can potentially destroy their lives. So they hit the streets because they have nothing else to lose. And you're seeing that all around the world. And we're also seeing a lot of civil unrest for other reasons, which aren't immediately tied back to our financial mistakes, like the Netherlands. they passed a law or imposed a regulation that would basically put a large number of farmers out, as something like 70% of their farmers out of work. And so the farmers hit the streets. They're shutting down big parts of the Netherlands economy. And now truck drivers are joining that protest. And that's a fairly important country in the global economy, and it's being shut down. And you're seeing stuff like that basically everywhere. Panama is having huge civil unrest right now. And Panama is usually a fairly stable Latin American country. It's a banking center. So it's not just countries that are full of poor people and who can't pay their bills and are starving and they hit the street. You know, that's serious enough and that's going on out there.
But they're not countries that are being mismanaged by some tin pot despot who's just, you know, ruining the country. I mean, a lot of these are democracies that are long established ones, but they're beginning to.
They are being mismanaged. You know, there are making huge mistakes, but they're elected governments. You know,
right.
They're not dictators. Yeah.
Yeah.
So nobody's immune to something like this, because when you borrow too much money, you lose control of your life, whoever you are. And so we're seeing it. And, you know, China is another interesting thing. They had a bank run with the streets full of people because the banks weren't letting people have access to their money. And China cleared that out militarily. They just sent the police in and kicked out all the demonstrators. But now there's a kind of a rent strike going on where people.
Yeah, well, I wanted to talk about payments. This. So, yeah, keep going. This is okay, interesting.
So anyhow, the background with that is that China basically engineered the biggest real estate bubble in history by steering most of its population into houses. And
sorry to interrupt, but just to add, Chinese real estate, I believe, is the world's single largest asset at this moment in time.
Yeah. And it's something like 74% of the average household's net worth, too. It's all in real estate. And a lot of big real estate development companies sprung up to serve this market, and they would take big deposits or full price payments on houses and condos that they haven't built yet, and apartments. And now those big developers are starting to run out of money. They're starting to go bankrupt. They're starting to default on their debts, and they're stiffing the people who gave them the full price, let's say, on an apartment. So you're seeing the potential there for a sector that is 74% of household net worth blow up in China. And the idea that the Chinese leaders have the slightest idea how to deal with it is just, it's hilariously wrong, because these guys have never really dealt with the vicissitudes of markets before. They basically issued orders, and the big companies and the government entities below them have allocated lots of capital to the things that the government was telling them to allocate money to. They have no idea how to work this out if the money dries up, other than to create a lot of new yuan. You know, they're going to have to inflate their way out of this crisis, because there's no other way to get out of it. And that's going to be very inflationary too. So, it's just not clear how any of these guys fix any of this stuff. And the question then becomes, who blows up first? And there's a long list of countries. You know, we do need to talk about Italy at some point, and Germany too.
All right, well, let's go there. Just one thing on China is they're a command and control economy. The perennial worry by the you know, Communist Party there is an uprising, right? Because there's so many people in China, and that's how past regimes have been pulled out of power. And so, you know, what they're able to do is they're able to come down really hard when there's an uprising, right? You just mentioned an example of how they did that, right? What interests me about this rent strike, this mortgage payment strike, is people aren't gathering in a certain place. There's no square to send the tanks into and crush the dissidents, right? In other words, if you get enough people that go on strike like this, there's just so many people in China, they just don't have the military might to go house to house and basically punish every one of these people. So to me, this seems like one of those ways where the civil disobedience can really get out of hand if it gets large enough that the government and its military might is just not big enough to actually contain.
Yeah, they can't put 300 million people in prison.
Exactly.
And they can't go, like you said, house to house and get payments because the money's gone. Those guys already gave their money to the developer. And to the extent that they have any loans, they can't pay them. So you can't get money out of the people who aren't paying, really, because they've already been stiffed. And yeah, it's not clear how you deal with that other than creating a lot of new currency and making all these guys good. You know, either they bail out the developers or they bail out the people who have mortgages or other kinds of debts and who can't pay those debts. And yeah, you can do that with an unlimited printing press. You can create all the new currency you want to and hand it to whoever you want to. But then you can't control the value of your currency. And in that kind of a situation, the value of your currency can just fall off the table, you know, can just crash, and there's nothing you can do about it. And so China has that kind of a dilemma. And they don't know what they're going to do about it.
Let's tug at that string just for a little bit here. So one of the questions I'm going to get to ask you is, you know, you mentioned the Fed is hiking right now. Seems like everybody and their brother expects at some point Fed'll break something, it'll have to pivot and it'll go back to easing. So it seems like we're sort of in this cycle right now where everybody was easing aggressively after the pandemic. We're now trying to contain the inflation that created. And so a lot of central banks are tightening right now, but it seems like nobody expects them to do that forever. And it expects them to reverse. So let's fast forward to a world where everybody is easing again, and maybe desperately, to use China as an example, right? Where, you know, they're trying to fend off this deflationary collapse of their real estate market. What does that world look like? If everybody's got the printers basically on full, yes, currencies are depreciating, but it's all relative, right? So who knows? Maybe the exchange rates won't even change all that much, despite everybody, you know, cranking their money printers up. How do we see the impacts of that in our real life? Is that just fiat currencies versus real things like the food we eat and whatnot just get so crazy high we just can't ever afford it? Or
yeah, well, there are two ways to talk about the strength of a currency. One is relative to other currencies, which is what people are using now when they say the dollar is strong. And the other way is against the things you buy with the currency, and that's the inflation rate. So we can have the spectacle right now of the dollar being inflated away at a rate of about 10% a year, official, while being strong against other currencies, you know. And the against other currencies is, I think, a kind of a meaningless measure because they're all being inflated away. So you, if you want to judge the strength of the currency, you look at what you can buy with it. And right now, most of the major currencies are plunging in value. So, and that's with most of the central banks of the world either not easing anymore or actually tightening a bit. So the world to come, after all the central banks engineer some big financial crisis by tightening and then have to reverse gear and go back to easing again and pushing interest rates to negative levels once again and ramping up QE, all that stuff, you know, which is out there at some point. That kind of a world is going to be one in which people realize that even with some inflation in the system, the central banks can't tighten anymore because to do so would blow up the financial sectors of all the major economies. And then people are going to realize that inflation is just something that's here to stay. The currency that they're using, that their government has given them, is going to go down in value year after year after year, and they're going to act accordingly. And there won't be anything for central banks to do, because they're proving right now, or they will prove by the time they capitulate and go back to easing, that even with inflation, they can't tighten enough to get rid of the inflation. And so we're going to conclude that that's it. You know, inflation is here with us forever. And see, that's when things really spin out of control, because there will be nothing to stop people from panic buying everything in sight. There will be nothing to stop prices from going up as a result of that. And governments are going to have no choice but to watch their currencies just kind of melt away, or do some kind of a coordinated monetary reset, which right now that doesn't sound like a good deal to them, because the currency that they go to, you know, the next thing that they set up will be one in which they can't just create money out of thin air, you know, and they don't want to give that power up. That's the best power in the world to have, really. And they won't want to give it up, but there will come a point where the alternatives seem even worse than giving up that power. And, you know, if you go back to that list of hyperinflations, and most of the currencies that were on there are still around in one form, but the government had to do some kind of a monetary reset to stabilize prices, more or less. So we'll have to do something like that at some point. And the question then becomes, what would it be? You know, what would we set up now that is more stable and more trustworthy than the fiat currencies that we have? And I think that'll be a fascinating conversation. And it's going to force basically everybody in the world to educate themselves about what is money, and what role does money play in a modern financial system, and how do you manage that money in a way that that keeps it from just being destroyed at the whim of governments. And, you know, it's going to be an interesting conversation. And I think we'll conclude that it has to be some kind of a system in which governments can't just make money up out of thin air to win re-election and fight wars and otherwise just buy off constituencies so they can stay in power. We'll have to do something. It might be a gold standard. It might be, you know, we're a long way from a Bitcoin standard, but there might be some kind of a crypto component to the whole thing. And it might be some other kind of commodity, like an energy-based system where oil is the thing backing currencies. I don't know. I would say gold and silver is the simplest, but simple is not normally the main criteria in these kinds of panicked discussions.
Right. All right. So this is getting right to the punchline. I'll try to reserve some time at the end to get back to Italy and Germany and stuff like that. But I think this is the meat of the discussion here, which is the you know, what do we evolve into, and B, what should people be doing today in advance to try to protect as much of their wealth from today's regime into the succeeding regime. All right. So let's talk about, the solutions. Great Churchill quote that basically says, in a time of crisis, the solutions that get implemented are the ones that are already on the table, right? And I think we've seen discussions of late past couple of years to try to get CBDCs, you know, onto the table enough that they could be around as a potential option. We've had SDRs, or special drawing rights, kind of put on the table in the past. But one thing that's definitely been on the table for a long time, as you said, is a return to a precious metals backed standard, or gold or a silver standard, because the world had been on it for centuries. They know that it works. They know how it works. Can you just give a quick synopsis of why we decided to get off it and not go back on it?
Okay, well, the way a gold standard works is that you back your currency with gold at a certain ratio. In other words, gold has to equal 40% of the circulating currency out there at the official price of gold.
And that 40% you're just pulling as an example, right?
I think that's what we had for a big part of the classical gold standard.
Okay.
So that's how gold was, that's how currencies were backed back in the day. You know, you could have more dollars circulating than gold at the central bank, but a fixed amount more. And that limits the supply of gold, because if you create more currency than that fixed ratio, then people will just go to the central bank or whatever government office they're closest to and exchange their dollars for gold. So the government's gold starts to disappear.
Yeah, and that's Gresham's law, right? That bad currency drives out good.
Yeah. And so that forces the government to stop creating so much new currency. And in that way, you maintain a more or less stable supply of currency. Well, governments hate that, obviously, because that means they can't just create all the new currency they want to invade their neighbors or buy the next election or whatever, or set up new social programs or pay off the military contractors and all the things governments love to do right now. They can't.
Yeah, every politician likes to share a growing pie, right? So this places a constraint on that.
Yeah. And they hate that. They've hated it all along. And the reason we went off the last vestiges of the gold standard back in 1971 is that we were fighting the Vietnam War, which is extremely expensive. And we set up the Great Society social programs, which were very expensive. And that was more money than we could get away with creating. And so other countries started demanding gold in return for the dollars they were accumulating. And so we had to just close the whole thing down. And at that point, 1971, everybody was henceforth on a fiat currency standard where all the big governments of the world had unlimited credit cards. And they did exactly what you would expect people to do, knowing what we know about human nature, with an unlimited credit card. They maxed that thing out, and so we get what we have today. So the question is, how do you set something up that that takes the credit card away, but still allows governments to function? And if we went back to a gold standard, we'd have to do something like back the world's currencies with gold at a certain ratio that was clear and transparent and everybody could understand. The problem is to do that now, with all the currency that's been created, you have to have a gold price that's really high compared to today. And the people who have run those numbers come up with estimates of anything from $10,000 an ounce for gold to $60,000 an ounce. So that would be very good for gold bugs. The people who own gold and silver would make out, and the people who trust the government and own dollars would be devastated because their net worths would just crater. But we have to do something like that. And like you said, familiar ideas that are already on the table are what get adopted in times of panic, because you have to do something. The world is falling apart around you, and that's not a good time to learn about some new thing that you're going to implement. It's much easier to take something you already know how to do and go back to that. And so there's a good chance we end up with something like a gold-backed currency going forward, something that's similar to the, in retrospect, familiar classical gold standard that was in place for basically 200 years before World War I. So, we'll see. There's no way to know what these guys under pressure, who are not very smart to start with, end up doing. But the pressure is going to be on them to do something that stops the bleeding. And that's a fairly near-term story. I think that's a next year or the year after story. So
wow, you think it's that close?
Well, I think that if the central banks capitulate when we tip over into a recession, which we're kind of doing now, and people conclude that, well, we still have 6% inflation, but they're easing again, I guess that's all we're going to see forever. Yeah, I think we could see the process start to devolve into a place where the only solution left is to stop the bleeding of the currency in some really dramatic way. So yeah, or at least we'll be discussing it in mainstream forums in the next couple of years, so that it becomes a thing. Something that, hey, are we going to do this? Are we really going
to
do that?
Well, then the average person will start talking about monetary policy, which you and I have opined with sadness for many years that our current education system does a terrible job of that. And the average person, the vast majority of average people really have no clue how money is made.
You know what's interesting? Cryptocurrencies have kind of laid the groundwork for this, because when you learn about Bitcoin, why it's a good alternative to the US dollar, you have to learn the fiat currency story in that process. So so people who are into cryptocurrencies already kind of get the death of fiat currency story. And there's a lot of them out there, and they're by and large younger people. So we've got a lot of half to two-thirds educated people in terms of monetary policy and money out there already. And that's a nice core group to kind of lead and participate in the discussion that we're going to have. And because they're young and energetic and loud,
right? Online, right.
You know, so once they get an idea in their head, they can influence the rest of society. And I think they're out there. I think they understand a big part of this story already.
All right. Well, even if many of them are smarting from losses in the crypto space, particularly the smaller coins, some of which have lost almost all their value, maybe perhaps the silver lining coming out of that is that we have some of these educated younger evangelists who, when this discussion begins to go national, can play an important role in that. All right. So before we get to the point where we're all talking about it at cocktail parties and on the sidewalks, sounds like you're saying, you see inflation really beginning to kind of run away, right? Because the central banks have gone back to easing and printing, and maybe even more aggressively than we've seen to date. And people are beginning to wake up to the fact that, oh, okay, inflation isn't going away. It's going to be around for the long haul, and it looks like it's getting worse. I presume before we have the national discussion about potential options, we're going to see that flight begin from paper to real things, where people are beginning just to develop that instinct of like, okay, I get a paycheck. I don't want to hold on to these dollars or euro or yen or whatever they are. I want to stick them into something that's going to maintain some purchasing power, because my fear is that next month these currency units are going to have less purchasing power. So is that something that you're expecting to happen relatively soon, meaning in the next year or two?
Well, I think we first have to go through a kind of a deflationary scare, maybe, because a lot of prices are going down right now. A lot of industrial commodities spiked, and that spike was in the June inflation report that was so high. And they've since gone back down. And housing in the US is starting to roll over. And there's a big spike going on in car loan delinquencies, which means the auto market is liable to get hit going forward. So it's completely possible that just this little tiny bit of tightening that the Fed did in the last 6 months was enough to cause demand destruction sufficient to knock us back into a recession. So the question is, what happens after that? You know, what happens after we have two or three quarters of negative growth and corporate earnings are starting to drop, which I think all of that is probable for the next year. And then at what point in that process does the Fed panic and go back to easing? And then we get the stuff you just talked about, where everybody realizes that, oh, That's all it's going to take for the Fed to ease. And we have all this debt still, and you know, we've still got inflation at a certain point. You know, we're still seeing prices go up in food at least, and we're going to ease now. And that's when the things really start to spin out of control, I think, from the point of view of monetary policy, because nobody's going to trust them anymore. But we still have to have that scare in the meantime. The Fed has to raise interest rates enough to destabilize the system. Stocks have to tank from here, and then the Fed has to panic. And that's how it's gone before, three or four times in a row now. So everybody expects it to happen. But because inflation is the wild card this time around, we didn't have inflation in those previous episodes. Right. The Fed feels like it has to raise rates more. It has to inflict more pain on the economy to rein in inflation. And the impact that has is going to be the thing that sets the stage for the next part of the story. And that, I think, is the really big story. When we basically just stop trusting central banks around the world and start acting accordingly. Well, Adam, you mentioned something that I kind of glossed over and probably should have brought up or followed up on, was central bank digital currencies and cryptos as maybe the next stage and says, and the central bank digital currencies, SDRs, you said, not cryptos, but those things are basically derivatives of fiat currencies. For instance, if we set up a digital version of the dollar, it's still the dollar. You know, it's still being inflated away at an accelerating rate. Same thing with SDRs. If we try to adopt them as the next version of money, that's just a basket of major currencies. It's some euros and some yen and some dollars. And if we don't trust those underlying currencies, there's no reason why we would trust SDRs. So I think neither of those things are long-term viable replacements for today's fiat currencies, because they just are still those fiat currencies. We might look at those things, but I think the conclusion is going to be that why would we do that if the underlying currencies were still trustworthy? And do we want to give up the next layer of freedom with these central bank digital currencies, where they can reach into our account, change the value of the money that's in there, decide what we can and can't spend that currency on, and track our entire financial lives? So I think it's going to be a hard sell. And all the central banks of the world want their own digital currencies. But I think once people figure out what the implications of those things are, there's going to be quite a fight trying to implement them.
Oh, I totally agree. So I want to recap one thing, and then I want to put some words in your mouth and see if you agree that they're accurate or not. So first, in terms of the most likely progression that you see coming, if I took my notes right, it's that we go into recession and we have this sort of disinflationary, deflationary scare, as you called it, but where, you know, Fed keeps tightening, it breaks something. We have a couple of quarters where things really slow and asset prices continue their current declines. Then we have a pivot on the central banks, and there's a return to inflation, where people begin realizing, okay, the Fed didn't kill inflation. It looks like it's going to be with us for the foreseeable future. That potentially will continue to a point where we get to a public loss of faith in central banking. And this is really where there's a lot of pushback from the public. This is where we're all talking about monetary policy and thinking we're doing it all wrong, and really beginning to hold those central planners accountable. And that, you think, will end at some point in a currency reset of the type that you've been talking. So did I get that progression correct?
You did. Yeah. And that's not a guaranteed progression, but it's a logical one from here.
Right. The best you can do is prognosticate, but it sounds like that's what you think is more probable than the other options you're seeing right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are other things out there that could change things dramatically, like us getting sucked into the war in Ukraine or with Iran or something like that. You know, a war would change everything. But leaving those things aside, assuming they don't happen, then the financial thing kind of progresses according to the pattern of the recent past, I think.
Okay. So if that path were to happen, then would this first phase of falling into recession with lower asset prices coming down, would this be a good opportunity for people to, no, you're not gonna be able to pick the bottom necessarily, but when the dust settles before the inflationary next phase starts, would this be, you know, kind of the best last chance to transition your paper wealth into more tangible forms of wealth that will keep their purchasing power better as we head into that inflationary future and the monetary reset?
Yeah, well, I think we should be doing that all along. And because, as you said, you can't predict exactly where the turns are, it's never a good time to jump with both feet into some asset class. So dollar cost averaging is the way you deal with that, because we can't know exactly what day and what year all of this stuff is going to happen. It makes sense to buy a little bit at a time of the things you think will benefit from that eventuality. And then, you know, that's real assets, like you said. Things that governments can't make more of will tend to go up in value. Farmland, well-chosen rental houses, gold and silver, energy assets, things like that are going to rise in value when you calculate them in fiat currency terms going forward. So, you know, make it a monthly program where you put $1,000 or $5,000 or whatever into those things and choose the highest quality versions that you can find. Don't speculate on things where there's a lot of attendant risk other than the macro risk. And just don't worry about prices at any given time. Just buy a little bit here and then a little bit next week or a little bit next month or whatever. And your average price will work out just fine if the big things happen the way we think they're going to. And you don't have to stress out over what your timing is.
All right. Well, John, so you're not a financial advisor, so I'm not putting that pressure on you here. But when you say dollar cost average into those things, what are some of the things that you at least put at the top of your personal list of what you would transition sort of paper wealth out to and into more tangible wealth? You've mentioned gold and silver a couple of times, so I'm going to guess precious metals are on your list.
Yeah. Precious metals, bullion. You want some physical precious metals. Think of those things as money. They're a replacement for the dollars in your bank account because they're older forms of money that governments can't make more of. They'll hold up. And there could come a time when you actually spend those things at the farmer's market or whatever. And one step over in the precious metal space is the gold and silver mining stocks. There are a lot of terrible gold and silver miners out there that will go bust, cost you all your money. Stay away from the riskier ones because of that. But there are a lot of high quality ones out there too that will hold up pretty well. And they'll, in a rising precious metals market, they'll go up more than gold and silver. So there's your capital gains. Energy assets, the people who bought like ExxonMobil for the dividend a while ago are really glad they did because that stock went way up when energy prices went way up. And apparently uranium is a big part of the energy story going forward. So there's some uranium companies that are fairly solid financially and might have capital gains potential.
Okay, sorry to interrupt a bit, just as you're answering this, if you can make a distinction. So I had a guest on this program the other week who was investing directly into agricultural resources, directly into oil wells. So they were actually owning cows and oil derricks and stuff like that. And I imagine you would say, hey, if you can get in one of those public private placements and you do your math and determine it's a good one, that's probably a really good asset to hold because you're owning the actual asset itself. But sounds like you think it's okay to own paper derivatives of these, meaning stocks in good resource companies.
Yeah, as long as you understand that they carry some risk beyond just what's the oil price going to be or where are gold and silver going. You know, when you've got company risk on top of the risk of the underlying asset, you need the prospect of a bigger reward to make that worthwhile. So those are the things that are a little risky but can generate big capital gains. So yeah, and you know, the big risk I think with the stock market or with well-chosen stocks that have underlying assets that are going to go up in value is that we're going to see a disruption in the networks that allow you to access your online accounts. That happened in Canada just lately and in Australia. That's the kind of thing that I think is the main risk for your online bank account or your brokerage account. Because it could be that you just can't get to that stuff for quite a while. And you know, while that's being resolved, you really don't know what you've got there. So that's hence gold and silver in hand. You know, the physical precious metals kind of help you with that risk by making sure that you have plenty of money when it happens. And then, yeah, if you can invest directly into companies that own a lot of farmland or you know, fine art, there's a company that does that too, or energy assets, that's probably a good idea if you choose wisely. And the question is, do you know enough to be able to do that? So you need an advisor with things that go beyond just basic, you know, high profile stocks in real asset categories or precious metals that are delivered to your house. If you want to go beyond that and you don't have any expertise in going beyond that, you want to hire somebody that you can really trust to walk you through that stuff. And, you know, those guys are out there and you work with some that I think are very trustworthy. And that I think is the next stage for somebody who has enough capital to really diversify in the real asset universe. You know, you do the stuff that you can do. And then you look for advice for the next two or three things that have advantages that you want to be a part of.
I think those are that's very wise counsel. And the Wealthion advisors, I'm sure, are going to send you a nice gift basket for the nice commercial you just made for them there, John. But I agree, and I think it's important to differentiate, as you are, that there's really two types of experts that you want to recruit to your team here. There's the domain expert. So let's take the precious metal mining companies. As you said, there's a lot of bad mining companies out there, but there's some fantastic ones and some ones that have phenomenal prospects and have great management teams and whatnot. But you really have to understand the industry quite deeply to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff there. And it's kind of a full-time job. You know, you really have to pore over the geological reports. You've got to know who the management team is. You've got to go into the company financials and make sure they're not diluting their shares aggressively and all that type of stuff. And the average person, myself included, you know, doesn't have the time, bandwidth, or, you know, in many cases, the expertise to do that. So you want to recruit an expert in that domain space to your team. So in the precious metal space, there are, you know, experts out there. I've had guys like Jeff Clark on this program, who that's all he does. He just, you know, Rick Rule, another great example. Tavi Costa from Prescott Capital, another great example. These guys just spend all their time in that space. And there are lots of guys that have newsletters out there that publish their top 10 lists and whatnot. And I think a good thing to do is to get a couple of them, see whose approach you like and who you trust, and then, you know, recruit that person on your team by either subscribing to their material or calling them up directly. And then there's the expert that helps you figure out how to deploy that asset class into your overall financial portfolio to add the right element of diversification, to look at your goals and your resources and determine, okay, what makes sense for you as a starting amount, as a maximum amount? How do we put hedges against this just in case the industry doesn't take the trajectory we think it's going to here? And that's where sort of Wealthion's financial advisors, I think, really shine, or any good financial advisor that's experienced in that. Although, as you said, there aren't as many of them out there as you'd like, which is why we've taken the trouble to go, you know, identify some of these good guys. So I see you nodding a lot as I'm saying this, John, but you agree that sort of duality of domain expertise and then sort of financial portfolio management expertise?
Oh, yeah. The potential mistakes when you're doing something like this on your own are epic and sometimes huge. And if getting good advice saves you from making one of the many mistakes that you could make as you're learning how to do this, then it pays for itself 10 times over. So you need to be working with people you trust who know what they're doing to avoid the big mistakes that beginners make. And I've done the opposite. I've just learned by doing. And so I've got this long list of horrendous mistakes in my investing past that somebody who had been there, done that, could have steered me away from. So I wish I'd had somebody to work with as I was learning who was trustworthy and wise, you know? So I definitely would advise getting good help, whether it's, there are a lot of good newsletters out there for mining stocks. That's one thing to subscribe to. You know, a couple of newsletters cost you a few a few hundred bucks a year. And if they save you from buying one stupid future bankruptcy junior mining stock, then they're worth it. And the same thing with financial advisors. There are lots of things that they know because they've seen it that you wouldn't know necessarily going into a program like this. And so, you know, it's definitely worth engaging somebody that you can trust. So I definitely recommend good people.
Great. All right. Well, real quick, we got to wrap things up here, unfortunately, but real quick, and this will not be considered as an endorsement by you, but are there any newsletters you want to just mention by name for folks to go check out?
No, because I'll leave people off the list who I don't want to leave off the list. But if you just Google, you know, gold mining stock newsletter or something like that, you'll get a list of five or six. And basically what you do then is just send for free copies, see which ones you like best. Google the people who run them, see how long they've been at it. And you'll end up with the names of some veterans in that space who have seen a lot, done a lot, and have a pretty good track record of, like you said, separating the wheat from the chaff. And I'd recommend subscribing to one or two, maybe two or three for 1 year, and then keeping the one you like best.
You like best. Forward. Yeah, I think that's great advice. Okay, folks, not an endorsement, but I'll toss out a couple of names I know of just to kind of give you some place to get started when you get that Google list. Obviously, I mentioned Jeff Clark. He's at The Gold Advisor on Twitter, which is where he publishes most of his stuff for free. There's Lobo Tigre, there's Brian London's Gold Newsletter, which was one of the longest standing mining stocks out there. I think John Duty still publishes one as well. So a couple of names just to look for in the mix, but take John's advice, just Google and start poking around. All right, John, well, real quick, just because I promised I'd give you the chance to talk about this, and I'm sorry we don't have more time to go in depth, but is there any sort of parting insight on what's going on in India, in Italy, in Germany? That I wish we had another hour to delve into that, but at least there's a 60-second takeaway.
That is such a great story. Well, anyhow, Germany, just them. They, in the last few years, made themselves dependent on Russian gas for the functioning of their economy, and at the same time, they started picking on Russia by expanding NATO right up to Russia's border, even though Russia said that's an act of war. We need defensible borders, you know. And so Germany did both of those things, which are mutually exclusive policies. And now they're paying a price for it. Russia has cut off Germany's gas, and they may not be able to heat their houses for this winter. And they're running trade deficits now. You know, Germany all of a sudden is a problem economy. Because of the stupid mistakes that they made. And just Germany alone shows you that we should not be trusting the guys in charge of the major countries anymore, because they're not capable of knowing what's in their own best interest.
And I think, and John, I'll have you back on and we can really roll up our sleeves and give this topic the attention it deserves. But I do think that is the absolute key takeaway from this, which is, you know, faith and authority dies hard, you know, in the masses. We all like to assume that the guys running the show, you know, are going to find a solution to things. And there's so many things we've already talked about in this discussion beyond just that great example from Germany, where, you know, one of the essential steps on this process of protecting your wealth is really waking up and saying, we don't have the A team out there. And I'm not making a partisan comment. I would put the blame on kind of all sides of the political spectrum here in all the different countries that are out there. But, you know, whether it's the US, you know, leading country in the world by most measures still, whether it's Germany, which was the backbone of Europe, we are not immune. In fact, we're pretty much, you know, I would say infected by poor decision-making. And it's probably only likely going to get worse here as the problems become bigger and more intractable. And so really the conclusion I think John is saying, and I'm saying here, is you really got to be your own hero in the story. You got to ride to your own rescue here, ultimately, probably by taking a lot of the steps that John was just recommending here.
Yeah, there is no adult supervision out there anymore. Daddy's not coming home to save the day. And so, yes, we are on our own now in a very scary world.
All right. Well, John, for folks that have enjoyed this conversation and would like to get to get to know you better by following you and your work, where can they go?
Well, I founded dollarcollapse.com, a website that covers most of this stuff, and ran it for 14 years before just selling it lately.
Congratulations.
Thanks. You know, it's nice to just wander around aimlessly for a while now. So I'll take a sabbatical of maybe a year and then come back and see what there is to do next. But dollarcollapse.com continues to be run by good people. And it's a site that that will kind of, with a morning visit, let's say, get you up to speed with the dark side of the financial world and keep you well informed.
All right. So dollarcollapse.com, we'll put that URL up on the screen here when we edit this. You still write from time to time though, right? You're not like completely away from the keyboard, aren't you?
Well, I'm taking some time off because I've basically worked 7 days a week for the last 25 years. And I'm ready for a little time off, but yeah, I'll probably go back and start writing again after that. You know, I'll post some things at Dollar Collapse and maybe, who knows, set up a Substack page or something like that. But
okay,
but not right away. That's this time next year thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Keep working on that tan. And you do look tanner than the last time I saw you. So it sounds like you're spending a little bit of time out there. Great. And then hopefully too, as it fits into your gentlemanly life of leisure now, we will hopefully have you back on again in the future on a regular basis on this channel too.
That'd be great.
All right. Well, look, and quickly wrapping up here, folks, just a couple of quick resources for you. One, John talked about the importance right now of kind of dollar cost averaging in to these assets. And just one service I want to flag for folks, you know, one of the biggest questions I get from folks is, hey, how do I buy gold and silver? And I've got a guide on there, wealthion.com/how-to-buy is a deep dive into that. It's all free. But there's a particular service at the Hard Assets Alliance, which is mentioned in that free guide I just mentioned. It's called Metals Stream. And what that allows you to do is set up an automatic dollar cost averaging purchase program. And you just say, hey, every month, you know, here's my bank account. You can take out X hundred or X thousand dollars every month. And I want you to put it into gold and silver in this ratio, 80-20, 50-50, whatever you want. And it's a set and forget it program where you set it up and it just runs automatically every month. And so you don't have to actually be actively buying every month. This system will do it all for you. If that sounds of interest to you, just go to wealthion.com/HAA and go look at the menu there for Metal Stream, and it'll tell you more information about it. Also, as John mentioned, he was very kind to cite the financial advisors that Wealthion endorses, but he gave a very good counsel in terms of why you want to be working with a good financial coach in setting up your overall portfolio strategy and plan here. If you want to talk to one of our advisors, it's completely free. There's no commitment to work with them. There's no strings attached. It's literally just a public service. Go to wealthion.com, fill out the short form there, and we'll put you in touch with one of those guys for one of those free discussions. John, again, so great to see you, buddy. Another great, fantastic discussion. Enjoy your very well-deserved retirement. And we'll have you, like I said, we'll have you back on the program again soon. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching. Thank you.